You know, farm to table may be a movement, but it's a way of life.
From the Coin Podcast Network studios in Portland, Oregon, this is Six Questions with Emily Burris and Ian Costello.
So how was Vegas?
You know that saying, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. I didn't realize my voice would be staying there as well.
You sounded awful on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's been a up and down all week. I've been a little raspy since Saturday night. I was in Las Vegas last weekend to celebrate one of my good friend's bachelorette parties. And we had a lot of fun, kept things pretty COVID friendly. The whole city has really kind of adapted, you know, some good protocols, and everyone's masking up inside casinos and hotels and pretty much anywhere indoors. And then, you know, we kind of did our own thing, rented a cabana at the pool to kind of have some space to ourselves, stuff like that. But of course, had a couple later nights. I mean, any night past 7 p.m. is a late night for me when you work a morning show. So couple of late nights and some dry desert air really did me in this week.
Yes, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Your voice stayed in Vegas. Usually my dignity stays in Vegas. So about $1,000.
Yeah, right? You know, I sat down at a blackjack table for a little bit and doubled my money. So I walked away up a couple hundred bucks. I'm pretty happy about that.
You should be pretty happy about that.
Don't know that I came out ahead for the entire weekend, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
I've got a 72-hour rule with Vegas. If you're not out, if you're not out in about 71 and a half hours, something troublesome could happen.
That's about all I can handle, I think. We were there for I think it was 3 days, 3 nights. So 4 days, 3 nights, and that is about my limit, I will say. So it was just the right amount of time, and I was feeling good to be on a plane back home. But, you know, I will say this, you know, Vegas has a reputation for lots of things, but it does have some of the best entertainment and things to do and dining in the world. I mean, we had some fantastic dinners while we were there. It is a really fun place if you're a foodie.
Oh, yeah. Vegas has done a very good job morphing into a destination that has a lot more than gambling.
Yeah.
And food is definitely one of those things.
For sure. And speaking of food, I'm a little jealous of who you got to chat with this week.
I had a blast. Had a chance to talk to Vitaly Pele, and we'll get into his story and everything that comes along with that interview here in a minute. But to address an elephant in the room, it was an interview that is very much a sign of the times. You will hear, as you listen to our conversation, a couple of things that are noticeable. One, I had my mask on for the interview. There was some social distancing things that we couldn't accomplish for this interview based on some office space. So I had my mask on the entire time. So you're going to hear that. Just know that it's there. You can understand everything fine. And the other part of that sign of the times is Vitaly was in his restaurant while we were talking, Paley's place, and it was busy.
Mm-hmm.
It was very good to hear it busy. Now, you can hear a lot of background noise and the people that were coming and going from his restaurant, but, you know, I'm talking to him in my mask, and he's in a restaurant that's got a lot of activity in it, and I kind of got to thinking that's kind of where we are in mid-August of 2021. Most of us should be wearing masks if we're at work and in environments with other people. But there is some life in the restaurant industry. So all of that being said, I had so much fun talking to him.
Absolutely. I had fun listening to your conversation. And I still think it's super easy to follow. So I don't want people to get discouraged. Definitely stick around, because you're in for a treat. I really enjoyed getting to hear his backstory. And everywhere, I mean, gosh, what does it say about Portland that this fantastic chef, who has been literally all over the world, has decided to come and make his home here in Oregon and produce fantastic food from all of his shared life experiences here.
He is a revolutionary in terms of the Portland restaurant scene. It was very good to get into that part of the conversation, but to hear the backstory of how it was born and how his relationship with Oregon was born in the beginning in a small restaurant in a small town in an old hotel in France. And that's when he first heard the words Oregon and started to think of the culinary things that could possibly be happening here. It's a fun journey to go along with him. It's important to hear him. I feel it's important to hear him talk about what exists here in the restaurant scene and why it happened the way it did and the role he played in it. But he also went out of his way to credit, even though we may think of him as the or one of the early bearers of the torch of the Portland restaurant industry, he was very clear that he wasn't alone. And it was good to hear him bring up names of a lot of people from a lot of other places in Portland that were his competition when he got started, but were also his friends. They were all working toward the one goal of putting Portland on that foodie map. Would you like me to refer to you as Chef Vitaly, Mr. Pele? Any nickname you want me to use?
Well, Vitaly is good. There was a point in my beginning of my career back in the day in New York City, my first job out of school, my chef or manager asked me what my name was. And I said, my name is Vitaly, but my friends call me Vito. He goes, okay, I'll call you Vitaly.
The relationship was clear right off the bat.
It was pretty clear he wasn't going to be my friend.
It's probably wise. Vitaly, welcome. As I mentioned, I want to talk food in Portland and some silly stuff with you as we go. But first, I kind of want to go down the timeline here. So how does a boy growing up in the Soviet Union wind up in the United States? And can you tell me what it had to do with playing the piano?
My mom and I, actually our family, immigrated the country. This was, I believe, back in the day, used to be called the third wave of immigration. As Jews, we were allowed to leave the country to reunite with our families in the West. And we received an invitation from our family to join them. And this was 1976. And literally within 3 to 4 months, we packed up, put our stuff on the train and went West. Ended up in Vienna for a couple of weeks to process our paperwork. And then ended up in Italy, which was right outside of Rome. I call it my Roman holiday. I was a teenager back then, so you can imagine the seeing things for the first time that I couldn't imagine that even existed. I did have friends, and we all kind of hung out together. We went to learn English. The folks that the organizations that helped us through the immigration process had a lot of activities for us. And so we ended up learning English and learning the ways of all kinds of things. But I was 13 and all I wanted to do is walk on the beach and have fun, play pinball machines. And I did quite a bit of that too. I began playing piano when I was 6 years old. My mom is a fantastic musician and a piano teacher, and she was my teacher all my life. I was a very promising young man when it came to playing piano, and I graduated music school prior to leaving the former Soviet Union. One of the biggest attractions of going to United States or landing in New York, as we did, is eventually going to Juilliard School. That was a mission accomplished and fantastic time through high school. While I was going to high school, I was also attending pre-college in Juilliard School and won several national and international competitions. So I was poised to be a pretty, I was poised to be a musician, and that was my mission in life. And then after a point, when you're in your late teens, early 20s, you start questioning your path in life and whether this was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And it was apparent I was good at it, but I really wanted to make sure. And so I ended up taken some time off, took a leave of absence from school, and frankly, just never went back. So it's a chapter of my life. It's not, entirely closed. And even though I wouldn't change anything that I do now for the world, it's still, you know, I still have a piano at home. My mom bought me a piano when we first moved to Portland. And every now and then I walk by it. I don't really play it very often. As a matter of fact, I haven't played it in years. But there's got to be a time in life where I'll eventually go back to it. Get the rust out, if you will.
You're playing the piano. I presume you're playing some public concerts. You're studying at Juilliard, and you decide to take this time off.
Yes.
When does food come into the conversation? When did you first cook something and say, damn, I might be kind of good at this?
What does out of school musician with really not many other skills do? Well, they land in the restaurant business.
And that's where you ended up.
Yeah. So I ended up, I've had several jobs in New York City, and I actually enjoyed quite a bit working at this one place called World Yacht Cruises. It was a small company that ran dinner boats around the city. And back in the day, this was early 80s, we had a fantastic French chef and great group of people, dedicated, loyal. My greatest memories kind of date back to that era. This is where I met my wife, Kimberly. Both of us were in the arts. She was a dancer and I was a musician. And we met in the restaurant business, if you will. Stayed friends for many, many years. I have so many still great friends from back in the day, and some of the greatest memories of folks that no longer are with us. One gentleman, his name was Mark Abrams, who taught us just about everything we know in the hospitality industry. And we always kind of refer back to what would Mark do, you know, in a given certain instance. And so as we got deeper and deeper into learning, and I was back in the day, this was front of the house. I was not a cook. I was not a cook. I didn't cook. I didn't start cooking. This was merely a server's position. And then eventually I got good at it. So they promoted me to an assistant cruise manager and then to a cruise manager. And then eventually my wife and I, you know, at that time, Kimberly was also a captain and then eventually became an assistant manager. And then something clicked between her and I proposed. We got married. It all happened so quickly. It really did. After we got married, I think, you know, the thought was, is what do we know in life that we can do together? And restaurant business tied it all for us. And at that time, I decided that I just needed to take my knowledge to the next level and learn how to cook, perhaps. And so I went to the French Culinary Institute. What I learned was what I still didn't know. Ended up in some of the finest New York City restaurants to continue to learn how to cook. Went back down to zero after years and years of working in the front of the house. And then an opportunity came up from a former friend and a former chef that was a chef at World Yacht Cruises who agreed to help us land a stage in France. And that was a kind of turning point for both Kimberly and I. So we went, this was early 90s, I want to say 90, 91. We ended up going to France and stayed there almost a year. Spent training, learning, living, absorbing. She did the front of the house and all that it required. And I spent all my time in the kitchen.
What did you love most about your time in France?
It became apparent that the seriousness with which the food business was being approached there, the restaurant was not just a job for someone while they're waiting to land a career doing something else. It was the career. It's what people lived to do. It's what they wanted to do. It's the passion that came through. Where we were was a little city outside of Limoges called La Roche-la-Baye, and a little two-star Michelin restaurant at that time, small hotel restaurant, which is absolutely darling and charming. But the seriousness of the food and the seriousness of the professionals, the chef, the sous chefs, all the cooks, the attention to every single detail, the scrupulous attention to every ingredient that came to our kitchen and how it was handled in the process only made it that much more enticing for me to continue to grow in that business. And after our stage, it was kind of interesting because the folks in France, the folks that welcomed us were so welcoming. They We only had one day off a week, but on that day off, they allowed us to take a company car and traverse France. And that's what we did. It was amazing. We literally drive, wake up early in the morning after a long, hard day. We would hop in this fourgonette, which is a small little pickup truck that they used to use to pick up farmers market produce every week or once every 2 weeks. And then we would take it on the road. We'd drive 5 hours one way and 5 hours another way just to see France, just to absorb, just to soak up all that stuff. You're only once in your life young that way that you can take it in. You know, it has that potential of having a deep, meaningful impact on your life. And we knew that this is what we wanted to do for the rest of it. A small little story that perhaps will connect some things to Oregon. And I've told this story before, but one day, and this is rural France, we're in the middle of nowhere. There's fields of hay and beautiful forests and streams. You go by these villages, and each village has a steeple of the church and a soccer field. And if you go by too quick, you missed it. And this is where we were, okay? Just to kind of paint that picture. And then one day, this basket of beautiful morel mushrooms, this is early spring, comes in through the door. And just the intoxicating smells that came off of this basket, all of our heads turned. And I asked the chef where these were from. And so my French was getting better. I was definitely pretty rusty. And there was one person that spoke a little English, so he helped translate. But for the most part, I spoke in broken French. And I asked the chef where these mushrooms were from. And he said, they're from the United States. I said, wow. And then he continued to say they're from Oregon. And I was like, oh, my God, we're in the middle of France. These are staunch traditionalists. Nothing is ever as good as what's around us in France. And all of a sudden, I think mushrooms were getting the best, and that's why they got him in. Fast forward, after more travels through France, we landed back home in New York, poor, broke, with the help of our family. We stood back on our feet, obviously, and then began scheming of how to make it to this place called Oregon. This was, again, this is 92, 93.
And maybe. You had never been here before.
Never
that.
Been here. So no, before that. Yeah.
Were those mushrooms in France the first time you had even thought about Oregon and Portland as a culinary destination?
Yes. First time Oregon came to mind. We never even thought about leaving New York. And we traveled. So then when we came back to New York, got on our feet, made a little bit of money. Landed a couple of really good jobs. First opportunity, said, let's take a vacation and let's go to Oregon. So we flew in, by the way, we flew into Northern California, rented a car, and drove up the coast. We traversed the entire coastline of Oregon.
That's a good drive.
Oh my God, so gorgeous. Yeah, we landed, first we ended up in Ashland, Jacksonville. That's a nice, charming area. And then we ended up in... driving up along the coast and stopped in Yahats, which was a fantastic little charming town. We haven't been there in years, but it was a beautiful back then. And we was like, wow, this is amazing. And then we kept going, stopped over Glenita Beach. That was another place. We saw this beautiful, charming little restaurant called Chez Jeanette. Now it's a little glass shop, I think. But back in the day, it was a beautiful little restaurant. It's just straight out of fairy tales, two fireplaces, small little ride up, you know, a block off the beach. We're like, this is it. We want to be here. Anyway, we sit down and we have a beautiful dinner and the food was fantastic. But what was most important is yet another French connection. We order a bottle of wine. And this 1988 vintage was so tasty and so delicious. But what it really, again, emphasized is this French connection, if you will. And this, all of a sudden, not only you find these mushrooms, Oregon mushrooms in France, now all of a sudden the French, the royalty of France, the Drouin family, purchased land here to plant vines, to grow grapes. Oregon is being elevated to yet another international level with the wine industry. And that's when it solidified in our minds that, okay, we got to come here and we got to come here soon.
When you get to Portland in the, mid-1990s now,
yeah.
Who did you meet? Where did you work? What did those first years look like in Portland?
Wow, fantastic questions. Thank you. Pretty quickly, Kimberly landed a job at Wildwood Restaurant working for Corey Schreiber. Then I landed a job working for Dave Machado at a place called Pazzo back then. It's on a corner, I want to say Washington and Broadway. It's inside Vintage Plaza back then. Now it's called the Vintage. Met Philippe Bellot, who just arrived also maybe a year prior to us and was a chef at the Heathman. Met Greg Higgins, who just opened Greg Higgins after leaving as a chef at the Heathman. Mark Gould was another young man who was a close friend of ours, is now a vineyard manager for Ken Wright Cellars. And he was a chef at Atwater's back then. There was also another interesting connection. The day prior to us coming to Oregon for the first time, just to kind of look see, Kimberly used to work at a restaurant called Boulay. And literally the night prior to us hopping on the plane to go to Oregon, Bruce Carey and Chris Israel, back in the day, who used to own that restaurant, reading at Boulay. And so Kimberly struck a conversation with them, not really knowing where they were from. And fast forward about a week later, we're in Oregon and everybody says, you got to go to Zephyro for dinner. So we're sitting down at Zephyro and all of a sudden Bruce Carey comes out and looks at Kimberly, looks at me and like, I just saw you last week in New York. You know, again, this fortuitous, almost like serendipity kind of moment where you said, we made the right call. We're coming here. This is it. So all these things are pointing in that direction, you know?
You get here, you get a restaurant open, and it took some time, but eventually you start to be seen as this kind of a driving force behind the culinary explosion here, especially this farm-to-table movement. You saw a lot of that farm-to-table stuff happening in France, obviously, while you were there.
Yeah.
Why do you think Portland was then such fertile ground for the restaurant explosion, the absolute proliferation of good places to eat? Why did it happen in Portland, and why did it happen in the mid-1990s?
The question is valid. Again, making a bit of a French connection there is one of the things we learned is being closer to the source of the ingredients was key to successful restaurant operation. And as we traveled to Oregon, we saw the same rolling hills in the Willamette Valley that you saw in Burgundy. We saw the valley fertile with beautiful products that were grown here. The seasons were, you know, the climate is fairly moderate. Yeah, it rained a lot, but when it stopped raining, Luco came out of the ground. And so wine industry was just starting up. The coast was nearby for seafood. The mountains are ripe and ready for foraged, wild forage products. So call me, you know, silly, but I think we've stumbled upon a veritable quandary of perfect scenario of a place that's good to live, moderate climate, ingredients that are at the ready and are here all the time. They were here all these years. They just took enough of us to recognize what we actually have. In order for us to cook here, the ingredients were all available to us. We just needed to explore them and hold on to more of them here. You know, the rest of the world knew supposedly about Oregon's bounty, but we here in Oregon never knew that existed. So now we do. And what followed in the next few years is kind of a bit of a premonition on my part that I said back in the 90s, we're going to see this place grow. It's going to explode. And it did.
And that explosion, part because of you and part pushed you, I would presume, to be a better chef and a better restaurateur. And you became an award winner out of that. Do you remember where you were when you found out you had won a James Beard Award?
Yes. Answer to all those questions. I believe competition and it provides for very healthy growth for us, for people, for industry. Us wanting to be better constantly made it that much better for the industry in general. And so vice versa. We never opened Paley's Place because we wanted an award. We never opened any restaurants because we want, this is the, you know, farm to table may be a movement, but it's a way of life. It was a way of life and it is a way of life. And so it became this movement. It became this buzz sentence. But I still believe it's the only way one can cook. One can operate a business to take advantage of local, what's available locally and seasonally is not only good for you, good for the planet, good for people that grow it, good for the local economy. I mean, the list goes on, you know. So as we were being recognized for our efforts, we really had a lot of fun cooking back in the day, and we still do. The creativity is alive and well, and the pioneering spirit, I should say, is alive and well in Oregon. And I think one of the biggest reasons for it is because we don't have those big, staunch traditions that some other parts of our country do. We get to reinvent and invent daily. And so that go for broke creativity attitude really takes us very far every day. 2005 is when we got recognized for our efforts by the James Beard Foundation, who received Best Chef Pacific Northwest in Hawaii back in the day. That's how it was listed as a category. And we won that category in 2005. And I was in the line of basically some of those other names that I've mentioned. The first one to get that honor was Corey Schreiber from Wildwood, then followed by Greg Higgins, then followed by Philippe Below, and then we finally got there. And it was pretty special to kind of be in that line of people that made, I'm still good friends with all of them. And I don't see them daily like I used to, but.
What did being recognized by the James Beard Foundation do for you?
As a chef, I was humbled and honored to be able to say that we're doing something really special, and that we're forwarding the entire region's mission to kind of be on the forefront of culinary creativity and supporting the local farmers, local community in general. As a business owner, it made it easier to operate for the next few years, as it provided a steady flow of business, which was a very welcome opportunity for us. You know, that provides for all the people that work here and all the guests that keep coming, and it was fantastic.
When we come back, Vitaly talks about the pandemic, the problems that came with it, and how he found a silver lining.
The Coin 6 Weather Team has the most accurate forecast in town, certified by WeatherRate. Coin 6 Weather, watching out for you.
Hi, this is Jeff Giannola from Coin 6 News, and I'd like to invite you to watch Coin 6 News at 10 on Portland CW. It's our award-winning newscast, 1 hour earlier at 10 o'clock. A full hour of the stories that are important to you and your family from the news team that's watching out for you. Plus, Portland's most accurate forecast certified by WeatherRate from Chief Meteorologist Natasha Stenbach. See why more people are switching to Coin 6 News at 10 on Portland CW. Watching out for you.
Vitaly, we're going to leave the politics of the last 18 months out of this discussion as best we can. I think it would be a mistake to have you here and not talk a little bit about the damage the pandemic has done to the restaurant industry, not just in Portland, but around the world. You've been forced to close a few of your restaurants. I'm curious if you can tell me, what's the hardest part about not only making the decision to close, but actually turning off the sign and locking the doors?
Oh, God, I'm not sure I can answer all that, but I'll do my best. I think given the compounding effect of the pandemic and the loss of revenues, and by the way, we're talking about, I guess, restaurants, one of them is called Imperial, next to it was The Crown. Eventually in 2016, we opened Headwaters and set Heathman, historic Heathman, to follow in the footsteps of Philippe Below, and then eventually got an opportunity to start something, a restaurant inside the Dossier called Rosa Rosa. So all those restaurants on March 15th shuttered based on closures that were mandated by the government. But, you know, given the compounding effects of the pandemic and the loss of revenue, difficulty of modulating the guest experience, and then fast forward to the summer with ongoing housing crisis in the city and the summer of uprising, we weren't, you know, all those things were only compounded by the fact that we weren't able to provide the level of hospitality that's expected of us. We made a heartbreaking decision to close our restaurants. At that point, looked for an additional ways to serve food, to provide for the local community in need. I participated in something called Feed the Mass, which was a great source for food insecure. I volunteered there for months through the COVID and helped put together meals. Some days we cooked for 1,000 people. It was humbling, but necessary for all of us, and to see so many thankful people and to be able to say that I made a difference in our local community in the moment of need. You know, we also, I think we started in April of last year, and through June, we served around 8,000 meals to healthcare workers who ate. The only food source they had was takeout pizza as best as they could and vending machines in the hospital. And all of a sudden, we're making food for them, delivering to them. It was a very special moment to be able to say we had control of this. We could help them.
Did it feel good taking back some of that control?
Absolutely. We all needed a grounding of some sort. We all needed a place that we felt good. It's part of our human nature, but it's also part of that nurturing restaurant hospitality spirit. This is who we are. This is what we do. If you do it right, it doesn't stop. If pandemic takes over, it just continues. Yet in a different way, we've said hospitality doesn't go away. The way we share a meal perhaps has changed a bit, but the hospitality stays. It has to. We take care of each other as people, you know, we have to continue taking care of each other and be kind.
When you see some of those changes in the hospitality industry, and you mentioned looking at some of the silver linings, do you see anything that you've learned in the last 18 months? Whether it's contactless payments, whether it's reservation systems, whether it's whatever, do you see any of that stuff sticking around and becoming a new normal?
I don't know. It's really hard to say. We've been, you know, obviously following all the guidelines and being diligent about it. The safety protocols that we put in place are here still today. Even though the cases today are again on the rise, they're somewhat different than they used to be. There's a little bit more certainty because of more of us being vaccinated. But I think we all need to learn how to live with this disease for a long time.
Are you optimistic about the food scene in Portland?
I'm an optimist by nature. I don't have another way. I always look on the bright side of things. I wake up daily an optimist. I may go to a pessimist to bed, but I wake up an optimist every morning. The only way to move forward is to have, you may not have a clear vision, but you have a clear hope.
Let's go back to the fun stuff. You're a winner on Iron Chef America, and you appeared on Top Chef Portland.
Yes.
And there's some other TV appearances under your belt. What's the hardest thing about cooking on TV? When I watch one of these shows that's edited, what don't I see that is actually happening in those kitchens?
It's funny. I think we're too far behind what had actually happened. This is back in 2011 is when the Iron Chef was filmed. So I can probably say a couple of extra things that I don't normally. yes. So the show is exactly an hour. They film you for an hour. You have a clock starts and the clock stops. You're allowed to view the kitchen slightly prior to, maybe turn on some of the equipment to make sure it works well. You're allowed to survey the plates and whatever else, but when the clock starts, the clock starts. So it's a true thing for sure. The toughest part was obviously you're in unfamiliar surroundings. You're cooking with ingredients sometimes that you're, you know, questionable. You're not totally sure if it's exactly what you'd be working with. The equipment is also brand new. You've never worked with this stuff before, so you don't know if the ovens are calibrated right, or if the nonstick pan is going to stick. while all of that's happening, you're running back and forth to the pantry because you've forgotten something to grab for the dish you're making. And then there's at least 7 cameras at you at all times. You can't be in their way because they got filmed. So while you're trying to make food for the judges that's supposed to be winning food, you're also trying to, trying to get those guys to film you correctly. And it's a It was a profound experience. Let's put it this way. It was scary. It was exciting. It was life-changing. We trained. Once we found out we're going to be on the show, we trained for months to explore whatever ingredients we wanted, timed ourselves, and found out how difficult it was to put food on a plate for in exactly an hour. With the first time we set our clock for an hour and wanted to make three or five dishes and completed about 90% of them, and then all of a sudden put it on a plate, and they looked at each other and said, oh my God, what just happened?
I like the idea of a training camp. Did you guys go away or did you stay at home?
No. We spent time at Paley's place. During the moments of the day and of the week where we weren't open to public, we would spend hours meeting, talking, training. It was definitely like training for the Olympics. It was kind of interesting. And we got better and better and better. We did it twice a week, sometimes three times a week towards the end of this process. But by the time we flew to New York to do the show, we were in shape. It was good. We felt good about ourselves.
So during the pandemic, you created your own kind of TV show of sorts, this Instagram series called Ask Vitaly Anything.
Yeah.
What was the premise of that? And did you enjoy doing it?
Yes, I did. I enjoyed doing it. You saw how fast I answered that. One of the things I was kind of scratching my head, saying to myself that I got to do this because I think people have done a decent amount of COVID-related shopping. They needed to do what to do with all those cans of tuna and all those cans of beans that they purchased. So why don't I kind of virtually come into their kitchen and help them sort through their pantry somewhat. And so I wanted to make it fun. I wanted to make it easy. I wanted to make it very engaging, very interactive. I wanted it to be simple. I wanted it to be simple enough and anyone knows how to do can do this. Anyone has any level of skill in a kitchen can do this. And as we progressed, you know, the level of people cooking in the kitchen became better and they became better at it. They started requesting things. And so we just started having fun. Both Kimberly and I were playing with one another on the set, if you will, of our kitchen, enjoying the meals after that while we're there and being creative. But it also allowed that connection to our loyal friends and customers. It provided for that necessary contact, albeit virtually, to the people that we have come to know for so many years, and allowed us to stay in contact with them through the hardest of times for everyone. And glimpse of light, glimpse of hopes every time we did this for all of us was an important process of acceptance, of understanding how to continue, you know? And so even though it was a lighthearted little Instagram live thing, I think it had a deeper meaning than that. And I know it did. I constantly, even these days, people come back to me, when are you going to restart those again? We had so much fun. This is so good. So educational, so lovely. It was definitely a lot of fun to bring people back into our world.
Vitaly, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. I've got a couple of quick fire questions for you. 5, 6, 8 word answers, just kind of to round out here. You said you drove around France a lot, went on a lot of road trips while you were living in France. I don't know if you go on road trips these days. When you do, what's the best road trip food?
Road trip. We haven't taken one in a long time. I've been begging my wife, Kimberly, to take one. I don't know. Good question. I don't have a favorite food on a road trip. A sandwich, sometimes while driving. Simple stuff. Turkey sandwich and a vitamin water.
First CD, first record, first tape you remember buying?
Queen, Bicycles.
Were you a big Queen fan growing up?
I'm a big Queen fan still.
Did you like the movie?
I did. I every time it's on, we tend to watch it.
Why is butter better in Europe?
It is richer. I don't know if it's better in Europe. But European butter in general is just richer than the butter we're used to here. And it has typically slightly more flavor, slightly more altered flavor than we would used to here. I think it's the wild cultures that are being used in production of butter that perhaps may make a difference. there are plenty of local, plenty of American creameries right now that are definitely making a difference. So I wouldn't necessarily say European butter is better. It's good, but we have some really good American alternatives that are fantastic.
One book that every aspiring chef or just a person that loves to cook should read.
La Ruse Gastronomique.
That was fast.
I could show you what mine looks like. You'll know I've used it many times.
Beat up pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. It's got some duct tape going on everywhere, but it's a book that I go to now and then, and it's a book that I go to all the time. It's a fantastic classic French, anything and everything that you want to know. It's a tome, just ingredients that are just totally just amazing. Yeah.
Vitaly Paley, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you so much for the interview. Really appreciate it.
The first time I went to London, my wife and I were walking through Borough Market. And I don't know if you're familiar with London or what Borough Market is, but...
No, I haven't been.
It's like Pike Place Market in Seattle, if the British had done it.
Okay.
it's their version of all this stuff kind of shoved under one roof.
Uh-huh.
And we're walking down by this little pasta shop where we ended up getting lunch. And we kind of come around the corner to this gift shop. And I see at the front of this gift shop, this Beers of America display, and it's Rogue, and it's Deschutes, and it's these companies that I know of from being here in Portland. So when Vitaly was talking about how he was in France and finding these mushrooms that had come from Oregon, it reminded me that our food here that we're creating here, whether it's beer, whether it's mushrooms, whether it's any number of things, is ending up around the world and influencing cuisine around the world.
That's so cool. I think it's so easy to take for granted sometimes, you know, when it's all around you here, just how good we have it, how agriculturally rich this area is, and how much of a destination it can be for cuisine.
He helped make that.
Yeah.
And again, I was told headed into the interview to expect kind of a star-powered chef. He remains humble in that regard, that he understands he helped launch a movement, but he understands that he helped launch a movement. He didn't do it on his own.
That's awesome.
Which I really did appreciate. And then the whole idea of the farm to table that he said he kind of explained was born for him in France, where, yeah, your ingredients are right outside your door, so use
them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's been so instrumental in really bringing that into the conversation here. It seems so commonplace now, but I think that is in no small part to some of his efforts, especially in Portland's food scene, for sure. Now, I have a question, Ian. Do you think that you would be at all successful on Iron Chef?
No.
Me neither.
The conversation... Listening to him talk about how they trained for it and how they prepared for it, I just had this image that they're, you know, I made the training camp joke during the interview, but this image that, you know, they're watching film and they're finding out how to get better, like they're getting ready for an NFL season or something like that. And it was that serious to him, which is cooking probably more serious than playing football, but it was great to hear him talk about how they prepared for it and the work they did and what they found when they got there. There mm-hmm. is absolutely no way I could compete. I mean, Iron Chef, Top Chef, Great British Baking Show, Great British Baking Show Holiday Special. Like, these are things that I like to cook and I like to bake, but there is a difference in those who can and those who try.
I am closer to ending up on Nailed It than I am than I am any legitimate cooking show. But it's really fun to hear him talk about it, because I've always wondered that when I watch, especially Iron Chef, when I watch that show and they don't know what their secret ingredient is until they, you know, lift the cover off of the food, right? I always wonder, like, they had to prepare for this. How did they have to prepare? Did they study an entire cookbook for a year? Like, what did they do? And so it's really interesting to know that a lot of these chefs actually do, you know, train in a way and just come up with all these different scenarios and types of ingredients and how they would work it.
Are there any cooking shows going on right now? Top Chef is over. Baking show hasn't come back. I'm short a cooking show.
I know. There's none that I'm like actively following. I usually just kind of flip on Food Network from time to time while I'm in the kitchen meal prepping on a Sunday or something, you know. Actually, more often than not these days, I'll find something on YouTube. Are you a fan of Hot Ones?
What is Hot Ones?
Oh, boy, do I have a fun assignment for you. You have to go watch this show. It's a YouTube series. This guy gets these hugely popular celebrities, like A-list celebrities, and he sits them down with a plate of chicken wings, and each wing has a sauce on it that gets progressively hotter, and they have to eat a wing, and then he asks them a question. It's like an interview about their, you know, about their life and their career and all this stuff. And they record them eating these insanely hot wings. And it's crazy. Some celebrities like don't even blink an eye. And then some celebrities are gasping for air. And it's always fun to see who can handle the heat.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to 6 Questions on the COIN Podcast Network. You can find our entire podcast library available on demand on COIN.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.